This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 189th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we are looking at Falcon number 1 from Marvel Comics, cover dated November 1983. But first, a little feedback, which we skipped last time. So this covers the last two episodes, Guns of the Dragon and FF361. On Guns of the Dragon, Chris Ouellette said it was a fun episode. Dan Schwent said it was good stuff, and that he read this first issue when it came out, but didn't read the rest until last year. Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, commented, "Good job, fellas. Guns of the Dragon checks so many boxes for me. Great to see Tim Truman take on favorites like Enemy Ace and Batlash." Agreed, Kirk. Such a bummer that this book has just disappeared. Disappeared from our collective remembrance, and also it disappeared from discount bins. Clinton from Coffee and Comics promoted this episode, describing it as two very educated and well-read men talk about pilots, soldiers, cowboys, dinosaurs, and magic swords. Oh, and maybe a comic book as well. You know, that's not a bad summary, Clinton. On Twitter, @ClassicComics3 said, "I was so pleased at my LCS when this came out. They had the first issue, I read it, and I loved it. I had no clue what was going on or who anyone was, but that didn't matter. But then, my LCS never got the rest of the series." Oh, I feel your pain, friend. That is a total bummer. And like I said on that episode, I have never seen any other issues of this anywhere. They clearly did not print very many because they just aren't out there. And we heard from Sir Martin of Grey from all the way across the pond. "Good show, kind professor, though the musical underscore was a tad intrusive." Thank you for that info, Mark. "I've never heard of this series. Was it actually advertised by DC? But you're right, I like the logo, clumpy and plasticky as it looks. It sounds like a decent read. How funny that editorial were fussed about the release, the relative ages of Chop Chop and Sam Bradley. It's comics. The timelines are constantly fudged." Thank you, Sir Mart. Exactly. Totally agree on both parts of that, especially here 30 years later. What difference does it make? And I would add, 30 days later. What difference would it have made? Nay, 30 minutes later, what difference would it have made back then? Regarding the presentation of non-Americans, I'd suggest there was no excuse for ethnic stereotypes even 25 years ago. Very fair, Mark. Oh, and thank you for bringing us some Ange. That always makes the day better, your pal, Martin. Excellent insights, thank you. And yes, Ange always makes the day better. James Williams agreed. "Dr. Ange is such a great podcast guest." True facts. Billy D from Magazines and Monsters wrote in as well. "Hola, Prof. Enjoyed hearing you and Ange talking about this chestnut. I live vicariously through you as I am too chicken and maybe snobby to try comics such as this one. Keep the fine content up, and I'll be listening. Cheers." Thank you, Billy. Speaking of Ange, The man himself wrote in to thank me for the invite, hoping that people enjoyed his ramblings. And yes, they certainly did. And you know, we don't necessarily specialize in the unknown and the obscure here on the Quarterbin. There are podcasts that do that. But I am glad that there have been many occasions where we've been able to focus on, highlight some of these lesser known works, even when they are, like Guns of the Dragon, produced by one of the big two. And then, on the Doom-centric Christmas-themed episode, we covered another obscure and relatively unknown title, Fantastic Four? 361. On that, we heard from Sean Urbanski, Professor Allen. I thank you and Kirk Spencer for your wonderful review of FF361. A few years back, I asked if you would ever cover this book, and here we are. Doom rewards his subjects. Yes, Sean, he does, though technically he rewards his loyal subjects. So, you know, keep that in mind. I've always thought of this issue as the perfect Christmas comic. I feel it has all the elements one wants in a Christmas issue. Dr. Doom. The entire issue taking place on Christmas Eve. Cold and snow, a rare occurrence in Marvel's version of New York City. A Hallmark movie slash feel-good plot. A desperate old buddy shows up to ask the famous Ben Grimm for help locating his wayward son. Trimming the tree and presents. An interesting, fun, believable one-and-done story. Plus, all the FF stuff we like. What? There's FF stuff people like? Well, sorry, that's just my editorial comment. I guess we'll see what Sean is getting at here. The FF stuff we like. Reed, using a Kirby-like contraption to put a cast on Ben's arm, and Johnny curing it with his flame. The Yancey Street Gang. Johnny having lady problems. Ben getting two cinnamon sticks in his eggnog. Dr. Doom's efforts to better humanity foiled by a bumbling Ben Grimm. And so on. Also, Sean continues, I found the Marvel coolometer interesting. While Guns N' Roses second from the top is correct, I would have placed Barton Fink in the top quarter, not the bottom half. Nonetheless, thank you for a wonderful Christmas Quarterbin, and thank you for those kind words, Sean. Robert Ludwig said that he had this issue and had to read it before listening. Good idea. Billy D. said it was great to hear some Doomy, plus mutual good guy, Kirk Spencer. Chris Lydon 7 wished us all a happy holiday. James Williams responded with the classic I Am Santa Doom panel, wishing us all a Merry Christmas. Mike from Comics in the Golden Age said, ooh, looking forward to listening to this one. Nice. And Apollo Kid 3000 reported that, finally, I found me a decent copy in the wild. Merry Christmas. And to you and yours. And we heard from Sir Dr. Ange, who reported his ongoing thoughts as he listened to the episode. Wow, what a nice gift from M. Doom, fighting the war on drugs. Interesting. Johnny's romantic issues oddly resonating. Such a cool show with a pair of cool people. And then, what? Did the professor just say that the Doors are overrated? Now it's clobbering time. Sorry, Doc. Let's keep in mind that we root for each other's college basketball teams. That is far more important than any musical disagreements we may have. And social media love for those last two episodes came from Shane Kelly, Derek WC from the Fan Holes podcast, Sir Luke Giaconetti, Pat from the Long Box Crusade, Vic and Phoenix, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Karen from Between the Pages, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, Tim Price, the Pod Crasher, Laurel Mountain Flower 1 from the Huntress podcast, Chris Lydon 7, the Remedial Shag, the Notorious JJG Jeremiah, Tyler Franks, Chris, the Charlton Hero, Sir Iowa's Joe, Popeye Otaku, The Empire 79, Ed Moore from the Superman Super Show, Chris from Professor Frenzy, Mad Overlord, Vampire King. You know, I hope Mad Overlord and Vampire King are friends, because they really should be. Evan Bevins of the Asterisk 51 blog, The Deadly Podcast of Kung Fu, Mike Resnicek, David Ace Gutierrez, and Sir Manuel Carmona from the charitable organization Comics for Christmas. Thanks for all of that feedback, friends. Let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll take a deep look at the Falcon number one.
Found the quadrant.
God.
All I want to know is what is it?
Cast.
Doesn't sound like any radio signal.
Dark Horse presents Aliens.
I don't understand this
content.
All we know is that the xenomorph may be involved.
Excuse me, sir. A what?
What exactly are we dealing with here?
Comic book adaptations of 20th Century Fox intellectual property.
How many different ways do you want me to tell the same story?
I got into trouble. My ship, there was an accident. We found an alien creature. It was very dangerous.
Spoilers.
A creature that gestates inside a living human host.
Yes.
These are your words. And has concentrated acid for...
That's right. We sat down there on company orders to get this thing, which destroyed my crew and your expensive ship. Did IQs just drop sharply? We homed in on its beacon.
This has been the Roald Stein Podcast.
We have it on disc, so you better look at it.
Okay, put that on the screen for me.
Now move it, people!
Why don't you just check out
the Dark Horse Presents Aliens Podcast?
Because I don't have to. Do you mind?
They think we're crud.
That could have been better.
Are you finished?
And we're back. Falcon, number one, at a cover price of 60 cents, meaning that I got this comic at a reasonable, sensible 41% markdown from that original cover price. The cover, by Paul Smith, shows Sam Wilson, his Falcon costume torn in a few places, against a brick wall. A blue brick wall, which does not make literal sense, but it does make the figure of Falcon pop. And it gives us the feeling that this will be a street-level story. The Falcon logo is in a style of being spray-painted or tagged on that brick wall. And we are told that this is number one in a four-issue limited series. The corner box is torn off on my cover. And the cover itself is bent and beaten up a little bit. And the right corner contains the familiar yellow 25-cent sticker, courtesy of Half Price Books. Sometimes you have to ignore the physical quality, the condition of the issue, in order to get a reading copy for cheap. The story, Winners and Losers, was plotted by Jim Owsley, with art by Paul Smith and Vince Coletta. We start on a hot night in New York City, and in a paragraph that uses the word ghetto three times, we meet a young tough named Miguel, who along with his couple of buddies, menace a local gal, Lucia, Falcon stops the worst from happening. And his chat with Miguel ends with the kid proclaiming, "I want to get out of this stinking ghetto." Meanwhile, Sergeant Torque of the NYPD raids a local drug pen, only to find the place abandoned. Falcon and Torque figure that Miguel's dope dealer didn't show, so instead of making the deal, he decided to menace Lucia. Falcon takes the young girl home to her father. He also manages to persuade Lucia's father not to press charges against the young men. Mr. Calderon will consider the request. The next day is another hot one, and social worker Sam Wilson runs into apartment owner and builder Daryl Kane, who wants Sam to demonstrate that he's not a slumlord. But after seeing the new building's questionable quality, he passes. Kane does not like the wild Sergeant Torque, but Wilson calls him one of the best things about this neighborhood, which these days is totally out of step with the way that some view the police. Later, Sam defends Miguel in court, believing he can become a good person. Lucia and Mr. Calderon withdraw her complaint. Back at the Kane building site, the character of Nemesis has arrived in a full-body suit disguising his identity. He has announced that his mission statement is that he will single-handedly destroy such structures as this apartment building before they are even completed. Torque takes a shot at him, but that just splangs off his chest plate. Falcon arrives, and after a couple of action-packed fight pages, Nemesis defeats Falcon using his electricity powers and manages to escape. And in a scene that would later inspire Spike Lee, Miguel is fired from his job at Salvatore's Italian Grocery. After that, because New York City is really just a small town after all, a drunk Miguel runs into Nemesis, who takes him hostage. Falcon also finds Nemesis back at the build site. He mocks him, telling him how futile it is to challenge him. But Falcon handles Nemesis much better this time. And just as he has the baddie subdued and starts reading him his rights, which struck me as kind of odd, he then hears Miguel calling for him. Because Miguel has been strapped to the girders above with a bundle of dynamite attached to him, that is so 1980s. As Nemesis runs away, Falcon tosses the dynamite away and rescues Miguel. Nemesis escapes onto the subway and takes control of one of the trains, meaning he now has 500 hostages. In a cool splash page, we see Falcon flying through the subway station with people cheering him on. Via his thought bubbles, we learn that he has deduced the identity of Nemesis. Now all I gotta do is stop him, and I'm really gonna enjoy this. Redbird arrives on the scene first, followed by Falcon himself, and he beats him up and unmasks him as... If you imagine this comic as a Scooby-Doo story, you definitely know who is under that mask. That's right, Daryl Kane, because it's always the real estate developer. And in this case, like so many of them, it was all about the insurance money. And he would have gotten away with it if it weren't for that pesky Falcon and his Falcon. Then, in the bottom strip of the final page, we have two very brief epilogue scenes. In the first, Falcon and Torque discuss whether the lack of new housing for local residents, now that the building has been condemned, is in fact a net positive or negative for the community and the residents. Kane's place wasn't the Hilton, but it was all we had. They actually do agree on one thing, that Miguel is the winner, And in the last small panel, we see that he has been rehired at the Italian grocery store, sending Spike Lee back to the drawing board to find a new location for Do the Right Thing. The end. Okay, one story that you've probably all heard, but it is sort of mandatory when you cover a book written by James Owsley, needs to be told here. So let's talk about his career, which was groundbreaking in many ways. Owsley became a Marvel intern in 1978 at the age of 17. The next year, he joined the editorial staff at the company, becoming the first African-American editor in mainstream U.S. comics. His debut as a writer came in 1983 when he wrote, wait, this can't be right. Yes, when he wrote this very comic book. Falcon Number One is James Owsley's comic book scripting debut. He left Marvel a few years later, ended up writing a lot of Green Lantern for DC and editing some titles in the Impact line, which we've talked about a bunch here on the network. He was also part of the original group of Milestone creators. Then, in 1993, as a result of a bet or a comment that ended with the promise, if so-and-so happens, I'll become a priest, James Owsley changed his name to Christopher Priest. Under that name, he has continued to have a long and illustrious career on such titles as Deathstroke, Vampirella, the current Black Adam series, and most notably, I'd say, Black Panther. These days, he tends to be credited just as Priest. Now, I wonder if this is not to be confused with a British sci-fi novelist, Christopher Priest. Because I confess that I once saw that name in a sci-fi mag and assumed it was the comic book guy. It wasn't until reading in the bio of the author in the sci-fi mag that I realized that that did not line up, and there were evidently two writers named Christopher Priest. I imagine I wasn't the only person confused by that, which may be why he just goes by Priest these days. But enough about the fellow and his history and his career. What did we think of this, the man's first published story? Let's start with an obvious thing. It's a diverse cast. I don't think I made this clear during the synopsis, but Sergeant Torque is a plainclothes policeman, and he is a Caucasian fellow with hair and a mustache that were definitely not standard police issue, just to get that visual correct in your mind. Then we also have Falcon and a lot of other African Americans throughout the book, and then we have Miguel and his crew, and the Calderon family. I did not see their specific heritage mentioned in the book, but I did the 1980s New York math and assume Puerto Rican. That is neither confirmed nor contradicted in the text, but that is what I'm going with. So three distinct ethnic groups in the story, four, if you count the Italian-American grocer, as distinct from the general white guy cop. But however you count the ethnicities, this is a diverse, mixed group of characters living close to each other in this New York neighborhood. And that is a positive. The flip side is the fact that the art, be it the coloring, options, the paper stock, general technology of 1983, that was not prepared to show a range of realistic skin tones representing characters of a variety of ethnicities. The best is on the cover, so I'm guessing that it has something to do with how the colors interact with that glossier stock versus the newsprint on the inside. Because the colors, I mean, for one thing, they aren't consistent. And it's not just the skin tones. Torque's hair and mustache also go through a range of color shifts throughout the issue as well. So that's just what you're dealing with a comic that's 40 years old. And also, just the fact that it is a physical artifact that is 40 years old, there's no telling how faded my copy is, how different this may or may not be in terms of how the physical, literal printed document looks now compared to how it appeared originally back in the day. Also, I'm curious if anyone has a digitized copy of this, either a scan or from an official Marvel source, and whether Marvel has used more modern techniques to update and improve upon the coloring, not just in this book, but in many books of the same vintage where that could possibly be an issue. So moving away from that topic, there was one aspect of the story that I really, really dug. And that was the fact that the last words of this were the and end. Both the main story with the bad guy and the side story with Miguel both wrap up. Remember that this is a 4-issue miniseries. Now maybe this was more common back here in the early days of miniseries, but the ones I remember them having ongoing stories. Now, maybe that is my modern bias, reading backward to how, you know, from how modern minis work to the ones of this era, but I thought it was noteworthy that the story totally wrapped up in the first issue of the miniseries. I'm guessing that the police sergeant shows up in later issues, Torque. But other than that, I don't see any parts of this issue that were threads that would have to flow in the later issues, because usually you see those potential storylines. But here, not really. What that did do was make me really interested in the rest of the series, if it is really 4 loosely connected one-shots. I'm just curious how this went, what they did. In terms of the specific story, wrapping it up the way Owsley did in 22 pages, there is a slight downside to that, actually. And that is that it did wrap up almost too neatly, almost too perfectly. The fact that the drug deal, the attempted assault on Lucia, the construction site attacks, the insurance fraud, the fact that all of these stories were intertwined, I mean, I know, if you eliminate coincidence from fiction, you'd pretty much eliminate, you know, fiction. So I guess that is really just a minor quibble at most, but there was almost a sense of it being too pretty, it being wrapped up too perfectly, if that makes sense. The insurance scam, the property development, literally unmasking the bad guy as the reveal, it was a Scooby-Doo scenario. And it was pretty simplistic, and I would even say a bit immature. But the writer was 22, so what do you expect? However, that is redeemed a bit by the very brief conversation that the cop and Falcon have at the end about the consequences of stopping the construction of actual low-income housing for people in the neighborhood who need low-income housing. He doesn't put this bluntly, but what he's getting at, the nuance, that questioning of how much actual long-term good was accomplished by Falcon in taking down this developer, that actually helped a lot. And I think that shows a glimpse of the type of writer Owsley would grow into, the skill that would give him a 40-plus year and counting career in the industry. The story, it just flowed from point A to point B to point C. Told the story very well. We met the characters. We got a glimpse of life in the neighborhood. We saw both Sam and Falcon in action, doing what they do best. And start to finish, this was a solid, street-level, early 80s comic book. Which actually brings up one more thing about the story, about the street-level nature of this. Something else that really doesn't work here in 2023. And it's not the ethnic stuff, which is the first place we often go for, quote, well, that didn't age well, unquote. Because the part that seems so out of place here is the fact that Miguel Martinez is portrayed at all as a sympathetic character. In the first scene, he's been drinking, underage, I suppose, and there is no doubt about what they are about to do to Lucia. Two guys are holding her arms back while Miguel is taking off his leather jacket. She begs them not to do this thing, adding, "Please do not bring shame upon my father, my family." His responses include, "You're gonna love this," and "Look, I can dig your family pride and all that junk, but I've had a rotten night and I'm looking to make up for it, dig?" In other words, you picked the wrong night to go out alone. Yes, she is minutes away from a sexual assault. Perhaps forcible rape, perhaps a gang rape. Make no mistakes, I am not exaggerating. That is exactly what the first page is portraying. And Sam's dealings with Miguel and the Calderons do not stand up to post-Me Too 2023 scrutiny. As Falcon, he pleads with the Calderons not to press charges. The boy Miguel isn't really a bad kid. He was drunk, and although that's no excuse, I hope you can see your way through to be lenient on him. To which I say, what? You're asking her and her father to what? A few pages later, the judge, a white fellow if that matters, is about to throw the book at Miguel, pointing out that he is a repeat offender, now charged with, to quote the judge, a despicable felony. And just before the gavel comes down, Mr. Calderon and Lucia enter the courtroom and say that at Mr. Falcon's request, they're withdrawing the complaint against Miguel. What can we say? It was the 80s. It is really hard to excuse. And these days, a content warning before a reprint of this issue would not be out of line. Not just for the potential act that is about to be committed, but for the soft treatment, the hero treatment that Miguel gets throughout the rest of the issue. And I understand it, Sam says. He's had a tough upbringing, but he's a good kid who deserves a second chance. What we'd see these days, and rightly so, is a lot more with Lucia and Mr. Calderon. Their after effects, her PTSD. I imagine the Falcon circa 2023 would have a broader view of the people affected, and I imagine his compassion and mercy would be more widely distributed, shall we say. But again, the writer was 22, and it was 1983, and this is how street-level stories worked. TV, movies, books, comics, this was, sadly, the way of things. Not an excuse, but there we have it. So what effect does all of that have on my final verdict? The verdict of Falcon number one, a diverse book, before that was a buzzword, a book firmly and forcibly set in the 1980s for good and ill, and even though it's a four-issue miniseries, this issue one delivered a full story, beginning, middle, and end. Problematic elements, to say the least, in dealing with the gender politics. But seeing a writer work his way through his first published work, knowing he'd go on to have a long career and a respected career as a writer, that does make it a bit easier. So with the stated reservations, I do think that Falcon number one is certainly a quarter bin deal. And that wraps up our coverage of Falcon number 1, bringing episode 189 of the Quarterbin Podcast to a close. Next month, or at least next time, which may or may not actually be next month, but for episode 190, whenever that shall be, we will be investigating The Maze Agency, issue 12 from Innovation, cover dated May 1990. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, the episode The Falcon, sidekicks graduating to their own titles, the early days of miniseries, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bit. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.